background, Fumio Miyashita, an untitled piece from March of 1980 from Live on the Baffo Mundo show. Before that, Basil Kirshen, we heard an excerpt of Special Relativity, an excerpt from his release Quantum. Before that, Richard Pinhas and Mertzbau from their KO Line release from some years back. We heard Chaos Line and Masayoshi Fujita and Jan Jelinek, Stripped to the RM or to the Rim, I don't know which it is, but from Bird, Lake, Objects. That's everything we heard in that set. Hope you enjoyed it. My name is Fabio. I'll be back next week. This is Freeform Radio, WFMU, East Orange, WMFU, Mount Hope, in New York City and Rockland County, at 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. I'll be back next week. Stay tuned for a special airing of Joe Frank, God Only Knows. See you later.
Fiancée Mary became impregnated by God. He felt betrayed. He'd always suspected that she was seeing someone. There was something in her face, a glow. She seemed flushed, the way a woman looks after making love. And still, Joseph married her. But Joseph always felt that she aimed higher than him. He knew that she was kind of a social climber, aspired to meet a better class of people, to get out more, attend more interesting events. She used to drag him to parties. He would go reluctantly because he didn't feel comfortable around these people. While she really worked the room, her conversation never flagged. And he always felt threatened at these parties. But he'd had no idea that she would actually get involved with God. The ultimate blow coming when she got pregnant. So Joseph felt very much diminished and humiliated. And he knew that everyone was aware of what had happened. It also pained him to think that it had been more pleasurable with God than it ever could have been with him. He felt so ashamed. Everybody knew the baby was not his. His is the great uncelebrated defeat of the gospel. That his fiancée betrayed him with God. That's what he's remembered for, as a cuckold of God. And then, when Jesus was born, their relationship was never very good, because Joseph turned away from Jesus. He was the offspring of a holy but out-of-wedlock union. And Joseph also turned from religion because now he felt that the piety and the sanctity were false. Because if God was capable of stealing his fiancée and shamelessly having an affair with her, What kind of sensitivity did God show by doing that? God could have found someone who was not about to be married. It's like the big bully of the town takes your girlfriend away, and everybody knows it. So Joseph never tried to make love to Mary after that. And it became a marriage in name only. And Joseph fell into a deep depression. He began drinking. He left home. And then he accidentally burnt to the ground the rooming house he was living in, because he was drunk and fell asleep with a cigarette in his mouth. And it was only through the heroic intercession of some neighbors that he himself was not consumed in the flames. And now he wandered the roads and highways. And he'd be gone for days or weeks at a time, and found drunk in somebody's garden or in an orange grove. He was hollow-eyed, fragile. And then, when he saw little Jesus growing up, particularly when he saw him coming into his own, going to the temple and throwing the money changers out, Joseph began to hate his illegitimate stepson for his success. Yes, he knew Jesus contained the seeds of greatness, that his son would someday be a man others would look to with respect. Joseph could see that here was a charismatic young man who had everything Joseph did not. He had followers and disciples, a commanding presence. And Joseph had always been a loner, always awkward. He felt that he didn't fit in. And when he did speak, he would often embarrass himself. Once he was elected to give a toast at a party and didn't know what to say. And standing up in front, holding up his glass, his mouth fumbling for words, people began to look away, the conversation resuming slowly. And he sat down ignominiously. Then, one afternoon, Joseph went to see Jesus give one of his sermons on the Mount. And there Jesus was, handsome, eloquent, self-possessed, not even working from notes. And Joseph just hated it. He found him loathsome. He was repelled by the sight of him. And very frequently he would hear Jesus' name mentioned at the well or near the government buildings or by the tax assessor's office. Another thing he found highly annoying was what Joseph considered Jesus' use of magic tricks. For example, when Jesus supposedly healed lepers, and that bit about walking on water, that really pissed him off. Jesus was just a show-off. And then there was that stunt with the loaves and the fishes and raising Lazarus from the dead when Lazarus probably wasn't really dead at all. They were all just parlor tricks. And Lazarus was a shill. And Joseph thought it was all utterly low and vile and undignified. Is this a traveling snake oil show? Joseph was also jealous of Jesus' 12 apostles, because Joseph didn't have 12 friends in the world. And these guys were like Jesus' crew. They'd go out wherever he was going to give his sermon, and they'd make sure everything was in order. And there was also a sanctimonious quality about Jesus, his self-righteousness, that really annoyed Joseph. He despised Jesus' humorlessness and his humorless following. He also looked askance at Jesus' involvement with prostitutes like Mary Magdalene. Jesus said he was saving their souls, that none was so lowly on this earth that he cannot be risen up. None is so loathsome that he is not worthy of having his feet washed by the holiest among us. And Joseph would think of this as utter sanctimonious rationalization for licentious behavior, that the man was a hypocrite of the highest order, a complete fraud, a phony. And when the crucifixion happened, Joseph was there in the back of the crowd. It was a horrible thing to look at, and yet he felt a secret pleasure, a secret sense of satisfaction, thinking, you want to stand out. You want to be the nail that stands up. Will you get hammered down? You really earned this. This isn't a situation where you were unjustly punished, chosen at random from a group of innocent people. You made your own bed. Now lie in it. And when Jesus cried out, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Joseph thought, your father doesn't even love you or care for you. And if I had been your father, I would have rushed up there and gotten you off that cross. I would never have let that happen to you, because I would have protected you. If you'd been my son, I would never have permitted such a thing. And when Jesus was crucified, Joseph had the feeling that it was over now. It was finished. It put a kind of closure on the whole thing for him. Now the whole episode had come full circle. It was a dreadful but somehow fitting end for Mary's act of faithlessness that had produced this person. And when rumors circulated that Jesus had returned 3 days later, it really enraged Joseph. And he really believed the apostles, these charlatans, were trying to mythologize Jesus and capitalize on him somehow. That they'd gotten together and they'd said, what can we do about this? We've lost our leader. How can we keep this thing alive? Who's going to draw the crowds? Nobody can work an audience the way Jesus could. We've got a real situation here, a real dilemma. And then one of them probably turned to the other and said, you know what? Let's bring him back. And this was the precursor of the sequel. This is Jesus 2, the God. Simply following the precedent set by many other gods of varying religions who had come before him. Zeus, for example, who had transformed himself into a swan and seduced the earthly beauty, Leda. A story immortalized by Yeats' poem, Leda and the Swan. Now, why Leda had this thing for swans and wanted to make love to swans and was involved with swans is anybody's guess. But obviously she had some mental problems that Zeus took advantage of. And Zeus also appeared as a sweet-smelling bull, and he seduced another mortal. Because gods have feelings too. They may not be flesh and blood, but they are not inanimate creatures fashioned from rocks, but living, breathing, vibrant, feeling, thinking beings, beings that feel longing and desire.
I just turned 18 in November. I was going to get married to a man who was 24 years older than I. And I had a great deal of respect for him, because he was very smart and he was very capable and he was very rich and he could give me many, many things that I never had, and security not only for myself but for the whole family. And also I felt like I had to get away from some of the things, some of the things happening in my life at that time. It was like an escape, actually more than an escape. It was just like I was running away from a fire or from a flood. My home life was not very good. I was not happy at home. My sister, who was 2 years older than I, and who gave me a very difficult time because of her attitude towards me. She made me feel guilty. She made me feel dirty. Everything I did, it was. But she wasn't the only one, actually. The whole family looked at me like I was some kind of a tramp or something, just because, I don't know, I was pretty and I had young boys admire me and so on. I never did anything that anybody else wouldn't be doing. The main reason why I got married is because I'd had a unhappy love affair with a young man from Romania, and he, after talking to me about marriage and a future and painting a rosy picture for me, decided that he couldn't go through with all these things because his father had died, and also he was far away in Romania. I was in Vienna, and the influence of the family and all that, and so the thing broke off, and it was such a letdown that I just couldn't go back to being a schoolgirl, going to school. I already had been married in my fantasies. I was married. I lived with him. I had children. I had a whole life. And suddenly it was all gone. It just went away like a cloud. It just dissolved. And so when this man, Meyer, proposed to me and asked me to marry him, it was a wonderful escape. So the big day came, and I remember it was on a Sunday morning, on the 29th of, now on the 2nd of January, and snow had fallen during the night, and the whole city was like blanketed white. And I was standing in my parents' bedroom, dressed in my wedding dress and with my veil and all ready, and looking out the window. And we were on the third floor, and I can still see it, the gray and dilapidated looking buildings across the way, and the corner where the five streets came together with a big clock on one of the buildings and the streetcar going through there. And I kind of was like suspended. I don't think I was quite there. I don't know where I was. I looked at myself in the mirror and I was pale. I don't know, there was some kind of a concept that when a girl gets married that she doesn't put lipstick on or any kind of makeup on. And I think I was a very sad sight. I guess I was sad. I think I was completely empty of any kind of feeling. I didn't feel anything. I was just like like everything that was in me had gone someplace. I was just like a shadow. Well, the day we went to a synagogue, and the taxi couldn't even come up to the door because the snow had been piled up. I remember having to walk a half a block, and so we got to the temple and went through the ceremony, but I was really not quite there. It was like I was someplace else, only part of me was there. I don't think I quite understood or didn't want to understand, or it was just like in a fog. I only remember that my shoes, my white satin shoes that I wore, were pinching me, and I kept switching my weight from one foot to the next. I don't think I heard what the rabbi was saying, what anybody was saying. Well, we finally went home to our house in my parents' house, where we had a small, how shall I say, a dinner thing, and only the immediate family was there. And everybody in the family was very happy about what I was doing, I think, except my father. My father, I think, when I told him, and I didn't ask his advice, and I didn't ask anybody's advice on what to do, when he asked me to marry him, and Maya asked me to marry him, he was the only one who showed shock. And he was, I guess, very upset, but there was nothing he could do or say. I loved my father. But in another way, I was looking down at him because he was weak, he wasn't strong. He was sitting under my mother's heel, and the whole family, and they took advantage of him in any way, and he was not a good businessman, and he was not successful, and he was not a good provider. And a few times during the last few years, he had to ask Maya for financial help when he got himself in some kind of a trouble and needed money, all that. Well, everybody seemed to be very, very happy, because that's like my grandmother's. When I told her I was going to get married to Maya, the first thing he said, "You're going to make the family happy." Of course, my happiness didn't count. Nobody even thought about it. Everybody was happy to know that I was going to be a rich woman, and therefore be a great benefactor to the family, which I guess I became. Anyway, so we had the big party, and not a big party, it was a party. We had a woman came in and she cooked the dinner. And I remember the first thing, I never had eaten turkey before, and she made a turkey. And I was just like dream walking. It seemed like I was only there somewhere, but my spirit, my feelings were someplace else. It was just like a marionette. I was just going through motions. Until the moment when it was time to leave, we were going to go on a honeymoon to St. Moritz, Switzerland. And we started saying goodbye. Xenia, our old maid, she was really more than a maid. She was like a mother to us. When I said goodbye, she started crying. And when she started crying, I started crying. And I was crying so hard that I couldn't stop myself. And I cried in a taxi going to the airport, railroad station. There were no airports yet. It was 1929, and I cried on the train. And I remember Maya, it was completely indifferent to the fact that I was crying. He probably thought, kid, stupid kid, or whatever. I cried all night, so he tried to make love to me, but he gave up because I was dissolved in tears until we got to St. Moritz. And we got there and we went to the very fancy Kulm Hotel. And the first thing I did, I remember, I went skiing. It shows you how immature I was. I went skiing. I went up to one of the mountains there, and I skied down. And then I took a sleigh, but in coming back there, because we land when the when you come down from your descent from the from that mountain, you ended up in a different area. You had to go back by sled to go back to the hotel. I took a sled, but instead of getting into the sled, I was hanging on to it. It was what you call ski earring, you know, being on my skis. And I was very perspired from the ordeal, and the cold wind in the and that valley was going over my back, and well, not knowing, being how shall I say, immature, when I developed later on, a couple of days later, I developed pleurisy. But that is not the the first thing I want to talk about at this moment. Well, the first night I came on, and instead of trying to make love to me like one would make love to a young person, you know, try to kiss and to caress and to sort of kindle some kind of feeling, erotic feeling or something, none of that. Maya told me I should take some oil. He had bought some oil, and I should put some oil into my vagina, because I was a virgin, so that would facilitate to break the hymen. So yeah, I was lying in bed, but the oil between my smeared between my in my vagina, and he came right on top of me and tried to penetrate me. And for God, I don't know for what reason, I will never understand, in spite of psychotherapy for so many times, could I ever understand. I was just like, I didn't know what I was doing, but I had him by his throat, and I was choking him. I was choking him so hard that he had to let go. And we went through this experience several times. Every time he wanted to, I was unconscious. I wasn't aware I was doing it. And finally, at one point, he said to me that he wasn't going to try anymore, because he wasn't going to struggle with this thing and so on. And he also didn't want to do anything about it. So the marriage was a failure, and but he didn't want to do anything, can't think of the word right now. And so he, because he didn't want to embarrass himself, because he was very embarrassing. You know, this whole thing was crazy anyway, a man of 42 marrying an 18-year-old girl. So, but finally one day I managed, after I think 3 or 4 days, I managed finally to not choke him. I didn't choke him, I just gave him a chance. So I remember he did penetrate and he did break the hymen, and I started bleeding. And I was sitting, I remember, I was sitting on the bed, and I was naked, I remember. And I was, I was a pretty girl and I had a pretty body, I know that. I was sitting on the bed and I was bleeding and I was crying. I was crying bitterly. This was the, and then the next day I developed pleurisy. And I couldn't breathe. I had a tremendous pain in my back. And I lay in bed and they called the doctor. Well, in one way it was a reprieve, because now he wouldn't come near me for a while anyway, because I was sick. And the doctor came and I developed fever, and I had to lie in bed and I was in pain. And I had to cough, and every time I coughed, it was like somebody was putting a knife into my lungs. Or when I had to sneeze, that was even worse. And then when I finally got a little better, I couldn't tolerate the altitude. I couldn't breathe. When I went out, I was just, you know, I just couldn't walk. So we had to curtail our trip. But I remember the first couple of nights that we were there, and show you how immature I was. I had bought myself, bought Lai gave me freedom to buy whatever I wanted to buy myself. And being a stupid 18-year-old, I bought myself 6 evening gowns. I didn't have a day dress, but I had 6 evening gowns. I remember sitting in the dining room. There was a couple there from a customer's house with their 2 daughters. And I was sitting there and watching people dance and being there. There was one woman. I remember her and I'll never forget. She was a pretty dark woman, young woman, in a red dress, in a red chiffon dress. And she was dancing with a young man, with a good-looking young man, and it seemed such a beautiful sight, the two people that seemed to love each other. And I was sitting there, my heart was breaking.
Driving in the Midwest. It was late in the afternoon and I'd been on the road all day. So I pulled into a motel and took a room. And I undressed, got into bed, and went to sleep. And I woke up at dawn, just as the light was coming up, feeling refreshed and ready to continue my journey. So I dressed, checked out of the motel, and got back out on the road. But somehow, for some strange reason I couldn't fathom, instead of the sun coming up, it got darker and darker. At first I thought it was some bad weather rolling in. But then, to my amazement, I realized what had really happened. That I'd been asleep for only a few hours, and had gotten up and checked out of the motel the same evening I'd driven in. And now, night was coming on. And so I kept on driving. It was a very rural area. Late at night, the place was desolate. I was driving along the road when I came to a slight rise in the highway, and it was this huge semi dead center bearing down at high speed, and there was no way for me to avoid hitting it. So I swerved to the right, and my car tumbled down a hillside, and finally, when I hit the bottom of a ditch, the car was upside down. But my lights were still on, and I could see the brown dust from the hill kicked up like a cloud. And I was hanging upside down by my seatbelt. And it was really disorienting. I pulled the seatbelt off and my body just fell down and I hit the roof of the car with my head. Then I kicked the door open with my foot and slid out. And then standing out there, under the night sky, I touched my body all over. I was grabbing my ankles and my torso to see if I was all there. I was in such a state of shock that I thought, well, I could be missing an arm or something. All the tires were still spinning. And I started thinking, what's my next move? What am I going to do now? There's no traffic here, nothing. It must have been midnight. So I decided to walk and I walked a couple of miles to a bar. And then I called the police. And I sat down and had a drink. And that's where I met her. A woman in her late 30s who apparently lived nearby. And we got to talking about love. She said, I was so withdrawn and unhappy as a child. And then when I was in seventh grade, I fell in love and I saw a light at the end of the tunnel. It was like the whole world opened up to me. I experienced that feeling of happiness just seeing him waiting for me on the corner. At that point, romantic love became my religion, my very cruel religion. And I asked her what happened with him. And she said, he was very shy. In seventh and eighth grade, he would wait for me and walk me home. And then when we got into ninth grade, there was an older boy who was part of the fast, popular crowd who took a shine to me. And the boy I'd been in love with had never even gotten up the nerve to kiss me. And this other boy did kiss me. So I kind of fell for him. It was such a mistake. Did you sleep with him? Yeah, she said. I slept with him. And the boy I truly loved, he disappeared. His family moved across the country and he left without so much as a goodbye. And you know, I still dream about him. And every once in a while I call up information to see if he's listed somewhere. You call up different cities? Yeah, I call up major cities where he might be. Loneliness, I said. Yeah, loneliness, she said. It's colonized my mind. But I don't feel lonely right now. And then I asked her, do you believe in the possibility of love? And she said, I feel like if you give up on that, you might as well shoot yourself. Yes, I do believe in love. I think about when I saw the light at the end of the tunnel when I met that boy. That was a really powerful thing. It was real. Why are you in a bar? I said. Because I like bars. I like the lights, the drinks, the jukebox. I like the kinds of conversations that happen in bars. Time seems to stop in bars. It's one of the few places you don't see people looking at their watches or rushing around. It's a place where people go in and decide to just be there for a while, with no task at hand or real reason other than that they want to sit beside another human being. So there's a sort of living in the moment, I said. Yes, she said. It's a time warp thing in a bar.
Chest, and I see the scar where God removed the rib from
from which he was created. It's healed nicely. And we make love in the grass outdoors amidst the flowers, fruit-bearing trees, beneath a perfectly blue sky, next to a pool of blue, limpid water. And then we look up in a tree, and we see the serpent, and he says, "If you thought that was good, why don't you try knowing something?" And we say, "What's that?" "You mean, eat of the tree of knowledge? You know God forbade us to do that. That's the one thing we're not supposed to do." And then we turn away from the serpent and we go off and bathe in a stream and we languidly reach for luscious fruit, enjoying the summer afternoon, the sheer sensuality of warm sunlight on our skin, the cool breeze on our brows. And then, one day, I look over a chasm, over some distance, and see Eve reaching for the apple that the serpent suggested. I call out and run to her as fast as I can, and I say, "Look, God said this is the one thing we must not do. We have everything else. For God's sake, Eve, we've got it all. We have a luxurious place to live. The sun shines constantly. When it rains, it's a benign, soft rain just to keep the plants happy. Look at the beautiful physical condition we're in. The years pass. We never seem to grow old. It's a small price to pay to remain ignorant. And what does knowledge lead to anyway, probably, but just a lot of problems and confusion and a desire for more knowledge and a disquieting mental sensation and conflicting emotions and dissatisfaction with the condition of one's life. I mean, I'm not really sure about this, Eve, since I am ignorant, but I have a feeling that this would happen. My emotions tell me this." And Eve says, "Is this all you want? You just want to be like a Philistine and eat and drink and be utterly shallow? Don't you have any intellectual curiosity? And let me tell you something. I really don't respect the abject submission with which you deal with God. It's so low the way you talk with him. You're his dog, his lackey. Sometimes I really lose respect for you, Adam. And this tree of knowledge, it is the most beautiful tree in the garden. And I feel a sense of emptiness that I want to fill. I feel a longing. I want to know things. I want to learn. I want to be somebody. I don't want to just be a nature girl, you know, living in a beautiful garden for eternity. I feel incomplete. I feel there must be more to life than this. I mean, for how many years, for how many centuries are we just going to hang around this garden, eat the fruit and make love and take long walks and dangle our feet in the pool and watch the sunset and listen to the birds sing? I mean, it's getting old, Adam. Is this really all there is? Isn't there something that would leaven this, something that would bring a little spice to it, deepen it, enrich it? I feel so shallow, Adam. I feel as if I suffered just a little bit, I would have some wisdom, whatever that is. And you know, Adam, the serpent, he's so clever. He's so bright and funny. He's educated. That's because he's hung out in the tree of knowledge. He knows all the apples and what's in them. And frankly, Adam, you're a lot of fun. But the serpent is a hell of a lot smarter than you are. So, I just don't want to live like this for eternity. I need more. And frankly, Adam, I just resent, I really resent that God made you first and then he made me out of one of your ribs. I've always held that against him. And I think, you know, in a way it's diminishing of me. And now this tree of knowledge business, frankly, it pisses me off. I mean, why did he have to do that? He let us have everything, and then this one thing he says we can't do. You know what that is? It's just a power trip that he's on. He's just a control freak. He gives you everything, but then maybe the most important and the best and the most richly satisfying thing, that's the one thing he doesn't let us have. And then she takes a bite of the apple, and another bite. And I say to her, What? Are you insane? Do you have any idea the kind of trouble you're going to get us into? And she says, eat of it. It is the most delicious fruit. I'm a different person. I feel this knowledge that I'm gaining. I see the world differently, and I see it from a perspective that I've never seen it before. And you, Adam, are a child. You are naive. And if you want to be with me, if you think we have any future together, you're going to have to eat of the tree of knowledge also. Because otherwise, we no longer really have anything in common. And so, I eat of the tree of knowledge. And again, we make love. But now, our lovemaking is more lascivious and violent and somehow dirty. She's wearing lace stockings and pumps, and I've got some liquor that I've made out of fermented potatoes. And we make love in the grass, and it's very passionate and frantic. But at the same time, I feel distanced from her. The intimacy and the closeness that we once had, it's long gone. Now it's as though I'm making love to a stranger. It isn't Eve anymore. It's Yvette. And when it's over, there's a sense of disgust and self-loathing, and for the first time I begin to feel that I have to take a shower to clean up afterwards. And we both wash vigorously, and now we're trying to find things to wear to cover our nakedness. And we find different leaves and bushes. And I used to squat against a tree right in front of her and unselfconsciously do my business while talking to her. Or we'd be laughing childishly and I'd spontaneously urinate, but now I find the necessity to excuse myself and find a private place to relieve myself. I have to walk 100 yards away to a dark place and turn around to make sure she can't see me when I do. And then God shows up and he says, what have you done? You have eaten of the tree of knowledge. The one thing I asked you not to do is the very thing you did. I offered you full access, complete reign. For eternity, you would have everything you wanted. And you were so willful, so completely self-centered and disobedient. And Eve says, the serpent made me do it. He enticed me. And I say, Eve made me do it. And Eve tosses me an angry glance, and I know she's thinking, you betrayed me. How could you say this to God? And then she says, you weakling, you know perfectly well you were a willing participant with me. And what kind of a man are you that you were going to point the finger at me? What a coward. And then the two of us are cast out of the Garden of Eden. And now it's cold, and I've got to work constantly, regardless of whether I feel like doing it or not. And I develop a taste for meat, and I go out and slaughter animals. And there's no medicine, and the elements are unforgiving, and there's the constant danger that lightning will strike and burn down the place where we live, that flood will overwhelm us, that drought will parch our fields, that locusts or infestation of rodents will denude our cultivation, that our skin will become infested with lice and boils. And I'm really angry at Eve. You got us into this mess, I tell her. You should never have listened to the serpent. I should never have listened to you. And Eve is saying, let me tell you something, Adam. I don't care. It's better here than it was there. At least I know something.
Ooh.
last night's dream. A machine gun nest was mounted on the balcony of an apartment building, firing indiscriminately into a crowd of civilians below. And yet, the people were utterly indifferent. They continued to sip coffees at their outdoor tables. A waiter had a bullet through his head, was bleeding copiously, but continued to be functioning quite well. A couple sitting at a table gazed at each other rapturously, though the woman was missing a portion of her face, and the young man's left hand had been blown away. Yet they remained oblivious to the world gone mad around them. And an old woman flower vendor, who was now just a smoking torso, continued to make change for a passerby. Another dream. An extremely beautiful woman, in a long trailing scarf, reclines in the front seat of a very expensive sports car as it makes its way up the coast of Tuscany. The moon shines pale blue down on the handsome, chiseled contours of her companion's face. My face. As he smiles knowingly, slips his arm around her waist, and we become a speck on the horizon, moving into the night of the Italian coastline. Suddenly realized that the only solution to the problem of drought in Africa was through the use of carbon monoxide in combination with Parmesan cheese, applied through pellets dropped by balloon over a drought area. So I drove to Mexico City. My driver was a Japanese woman with one arm who never spoke a word during the trip. Unfortunately, we drove right into a taco factory, setting off a series of detonations, and I almost suffocated in an explosion of beans and cheese. I had written a series of monographs on the relationship of filaments to deodorant soap, and, you know, I couldn't believe she tried to make love to me again with my ankle still broken and my new ear prosthesis and my scalp still irritated from that damned ointment. And huge beer bellies? Or do you prefer fastidious little college professors with starched blue shirts and bow ties preciously discussing the poetry of Marian Moore, smelling vaguely of Dunhill cologne? Thank you. This is Joe Frank. You have been listening to Somewhere Out There, created in collaboration with David Rapkin. Recorded, edited, and mixed by Theo Mondel. Music production by Bob Carlson. Special thanks to Christine McKenna, Jennifer Farrow, Carly Eisman, and Esme Gregson. Somewhere Out There will return next week at the same time.
You've been listening to Joe Frank on WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, and 91.9 in Rockland County, New York, and New York City, and worldwide on the internet, WFMU.org. Up next is Miracle Nutrition with Hardy Waite, so please stay tuned to WFMU.
Welcome to Miracle Nutrition with Hardy Waite. I'm Hardy Waite. Join me now, won't you, as we be human together, all together in this special place for it, a sort of humatarium. Is that right? A humadrome, where we all get to be ourselves, all these souls together, longing for joy. Did you ever see a duck with the head of Mr. Spock? Duck, Spock, duck, Spock. Did you ever see a leaf that looked like a knife? Leaf, knife, leaf, knife. Did you ever see a puppet as tall as a tree? Puppetry. Puppetry, puppetry. What are you doing, Hardy? Well, I'm trying to write a children's book. That's my new aspiration. I would like to write for children because I believe that children are our future elderly. And we need to give them memories so they'll have something to forget in the future. Oh, I love children. They're full of potential. Oh, and they'll believe anything you tell them. It's wonderful. They're like a tabula rasa. Look at this canvas. What am I going to paint on it? Oh, benevolent lies. I'm going to tell them stories. And that's why I'm here to tell you a story. You get to be a child again. Go ahead. Be fearful of commonplace things. Wet your pants. Anything you want. We're going to be children for a while. We're going to get in touch with our playful side. Some people have different sides. Did you ever see the old carnival scene? Half of me is dressed as a woman, and then my clothes actually divide right down the middle like that. And my other half, I don't know, is a pirate or an alien. Who knows who you are? You're made up of all sorts of things. We are a wonderful stew, a burgoo made of all of our experiences. And I would like to add some things into your stew. I see you already have corn and some potatoes in there, some chunks of something. You know what I'd like to put in there? Dice. I think that'd look fun. It might not be edible. Have you ever seen they make edible things look inedible? I think that's a wonderful thing. When you say, oh, is that, looks like just an ordinary alarm clock. No, it's all made of marzipan. What about that over there? It looks like a coffee mug. Marzipan? Is everything here made of marzipan? It is. It is. But here's the irony. I don't like marzipan. So technically for me, it's not edible. I hope that my show is edible for you. I wish you could eat this show. And you can't really. I don't know that you can eat things that you hear. I know that there's a synesthesia where people see colors and hear colors and smell colors, but I don't know if you could eat sound. It'd be wonderful if you could just live on a diet. What have you been? I'm on a special diet. I'm just eating early David Bowie right now. It's satisfying to me. It fills me up. And I'm pooping out the cars or something like that. Who knows what your digestive system does to things. When I was a child, I would love any story that involved becoming very tiny. I thought that was the most wonderful thing in the world. And there's lots of stories like that where they shrink down and they go inside a human body, or they shrink down and they go inside, I don't know, an animal's body, or I don't, now I'm thinking about it, I don't remember. The worst is when you shrink down, but you're in outer space, so you can't tell because it's not relative to anything. So I don't know how small I am. I could be very, very tiny or very, very large, but because I'm in out here in space, I don't know, because size is a relative thing. We always say, oh, you know, we're on a small planet, we're all very tiny. Yeah, I mean, not really, though, because there's no giants walking around in space, so, you know, locally, I'm large. Oh, and like Walt Whitman, I have a beard. I contain multitudes of beards. There's so many in me. I have so many internal facial styles. Oh, that's why children love to dress up, too. I'm going to pretend to be all sorts of things. And then when we get to be older, we stop pretending. And then when we get very old, we have to pretend again because we don't maybe fully remember who we are. So I'm going to try to remember desperately who I am. I would like to remind you who you are. You are everyone and no one. And I would like you to step into my office now, which sort of looks like Santa's workshop, and free your mind. You have no more responsibility, not for the next hour. For the next hour, you are free to explore the universe, free to explore your mind. Hardy, I know what's in my mind. It's like an old shop I have to go to every day, and I'm selling face cream, and nobody wants it, and it's all avocado and cucumber and everything flavor. Nobody wants to rub that on their face anymore. Very 70s. And I say to you, my friend, there are probably areas of that shop that you have not explored. Did you know that there's a little mouse living in the corner there? There is, yes. And that was the inspiration of my book, The Little Mouse Refinances His Hole. And it's for both adults and children. The children love the little mouse part. And then the adults learn about getting a second mortgage or a home improvement loan and how you go about step-by-step applying for that and what financial institutions can help you out and what's the best kind of cheese and what makes the best tiny furniture. But until you've explored your store in your mind, you don't... Was that the bell? Did somebody come in? I heard the bell ring. I got to go for a minute. I got a customer. Hello, friend. How are you today? I am fine, sir. I would like to purchase something at your store. Well, do you know what you want? No. What kind of store is it? Well, you tell me what you want, and I'll tell you whether we have it. All right. Peace of mind. I've got some for you. Here it is. Well, it looks like a jar of vinegar. It is. It is a jar of vinegar. I don't know what to tell you. Vinegar doesn't usually come in jars, does it? It comes in bottles, but you can see that the label says vinegar, so you assume that's what it is. Yes, I did, but really, it's my pet's urine sample. I'm taking my pet elephant, and I'm taking it to the zoo, because they've decided to replace all the animals with their waste. So instead of, it's much more humane, so instead of going to the zoo and, say, seeing a giraffe or a rhinoceros, you would just see their poo. And I think that makes more sense. You can learn so much from an animal's waste. You go through it, you can see what they ate. You can see how big they are. But say, oh, man, that's pretty big. That's because it came from an elephant. And it looks like it's got some hay in it that didn't get digested very well. Well, you know, he's older. But you can learn a lot from that. Scientists can take very tiny things, like, let's say, a bone. I did this experiment. I cut off one of my fingers, and I got all the flesh off of it, and I gave it to a scientist friend. I said, tell me if you can figure out what kind of animal that's from. And he said, well, that's a human finger bone. And I was like, oh, dang. I thought it would trick you more than that. Now I'm missing a finger. But there you go. You live and you learn, and you lose limbs. Not necessarily. If you do things in your imagination, if you go into a sort of Star Trek holodeck, you can play out entire lives like that in the safety of your imagination. And that's why I invite you to come in here and think all sorts of things. What would it be like, you know, if my ears were very, very large or something? And what if everybody had large ears? It wouldn't be comical. And I'd be able to hear so many things, just like a tiny mouse. You know, some of them have very, very large ears. And you think, oh, if I had ears that large, I'd go into the wax business, because I'd be producing so much and make little things out of the wax. The bodies produce all sorts of things that you can use. Do you know that most of the dust in your house is skin from the old lady who used to live there? Yes. It's not. Where do you think it comes from? Where do you think your dust comes from, kid? Chromosomes. How do you know you have them? Drugs. That's right. And if we watched a lot of TV when we were young, we got a lot of information like that. Say, I want to know about the universe. Ads. That's how you do it. I settle down and I watch one of these TV shows. I'm more fascinated by the commercials. They tell me more inadvertently about the condition, the human condition, than the shows do. There's this channel, one of them, and it only shows old shows from when I was a kid. So I'm watching, the other day I'm watching MASH or something, or Hogan's Heroes. I get them confused. Are they the same? They're both.